September 6, 2012, it's the Drupalize Me podcast. All right. Well, hi there. I'm Kyle Hoffmeyer. I'm your host today for the Drupalize Me podcast. Apparently, I guess, once in a while, Addison does like to take a vacation, and she is enjoying that. So I'm hosting today, and today I am here with some other bots, and we're going to be talking about the bad words sometimes, maybe, I don't know, but it's going to be talking about workflows. And before I introduce who's joining us on today's podcast, this is where we like to give you a ginormous list of events, but this time we're keeping it simple, because we've got, coming up September 23rd through the 27th, DrupalCon Prague. I'm excited about this one because I get to attend, and actually the entire Drupalize Me team will be there. So come find our booth, come say hello, and I also know that there's quite a few other Lullabots that are going to be there. I know Sally and Micah's all going to be there, and Wampy. So come, if you're going to be there, come say hi and check it out. And that's what we got for events. So who do we got here on the podcast today? I am joined with Jared Bittner.
Hello.
And Joe Schindelar.
Hey there.
And Emma Westby.
Hello.
All right. So we're talking workflow, and that can mean a heck of a lot of things. What is it that we are going to teach people today? Because that's what we like to do here. Anyone want to kind of jump in and discuss our workflow?
I think maybe a good way to kick it off would just be to like have each of us go around and say, like, when Kyle says the word workflow, what does that mean to you? And I can start with that from my perspective, and in this case really talking about sort of a developer workflow or the workflow as it relates to some project that you're working on. And for me, workflow refers to kind of the process that I go to or go through, rather, all the way from describing the task that I'm going to work on to working on that task and making changes to either a code base or writing content or whatever the case may be. Making sure that the changes that I make are incorporated into the final product, having that final product deployed to wherever people get to see it, and ultimately getting to like check that to-do off of my list. So it's kind of like really this process that I repeat over and over and over every single day to find an item to work on and then do all the things I need to do on it and then check it off.
So Joe, you have a great workflow there. How come all the time I've been working with you, this hasn't been documented? Do we need a workflow for you to document your workflow?
Maybe.
Well, Lullabot, we know there is someone that sometimes we kind of think of the king of workflows, and that's Jared. And I'm sure he's got something very interesting he might want to tell us about his workflow.
Yeah, I guess I don't like to call it workflow. That's the big thing. Because, you know, Drupal has workflows. There's like a workbench module, and when we talk about workflows a lot with clients, we're typically talking about like an editorial workflow. So I tend not to like to talk about workflow. I tend to like to talk about processes, just because it kind of gives that level of separation. And in particular, we're talking about developer workflows. So I don't know. There's many different things a developer workflow can be, and quite typically we have solutions for various scenarios, I would say, and it's they're always evolving. I'm a process guy. I've even been accused of by clients of the guy who changes process more than anybody I've ever known, because I like to optimize. I don't know, if we're in a process and all of a sudden it's not working, I want to change it because I want to make it more efficient. Sometimes that can be a problem, I guess, but you know, yeah. So when we talk about developer workflow, you know, we are, like Joe said, talking about where does it start and where does it end? Like, how do I get from here's what the client expects to here's the code on the website and showing it to the client? So
do you have a blueprint that you at least start from? Do you have a, like, I mean, Joe kind of had a pretty strict methodology there, not that he may stick to it or not, but is there a certain blueprint you work with, especially when it comes to dealing with clients?
Well, when it comes to dealing with clients, I think we're talking about kind of a completely different process. Because, you know, while there's a developer workflow, which Joe outlined, you know, I have, I guess, my ideals of how we should start. But that does start with the client, and it typically starts with, let's talk to the client, let's see how they work, let's see where their level of understanding is, and then try to work with that. Let's try to work with their process first, because it can be very frustrating to a client if we come in and say, listen, this is our process and you're going to work with it, type of thing. So yeah, it's starting with the client. We typically figure out, how do they work? What's their level of understanding? And try to adapt to that, to how they work. And what we're trying to get out of that when we start that process is really just like, you know, what are the specs, or what sort of reporting capabilities do you need? You know, what level of involvement do you have, and what sort of visibility do you need into how we're working and what we're working, and when do you want status updates and things like that.
I wonder if it's worth like stepping back for a second. Maybe it's not really a blueprint per se, but I'm guessing that it's pretty safe to say that at Lullabot, all of our projects have a workflow that in some way or another involves a handful of different tools. And those tools are things like Git for version control, some kind of ticket managing system, whether that's issue queues on GitHub or Drupal.org or on Fuddle. You know, obviously you have workers that are part of the workflow, the people that are actually getting something done. And when we're talking about workflows in this case, it's sort of like, how do we make use of all of those different tools in order to get our jobs done on a daily basis? And like Jared is referring to, sometimes we work with a client who already has some of these tools in place. Like they've maybe already decided that they use Jira for doing their ticket tracking, or, you know, maybe they use SVN and they're not willing to change to using Git. And so sort of the tools are still there, but now we have to adjust to a workflow that accommodates the various tools that we're using. And then once you kind of have those tools in place and you've decided like, okay, this is the ticket tracking system we're going to use, figuring out, can you accommodate the needs of everyone on the project in terms of reporting and all those things that you were talking about, Jared? And if you can't, what do? Can you just say, sorry, we can't do that? Or do you decide that, well, we'll switch to a different tool that can accomplish all of those things. But for me, it's kind of like workflow is the way that I interact with and have all of those tools interact with one another.
Yeah, by talking to the client about their workflow and about their expectations more, we kind of customize the workflow to that. So, you know, if they really want some highly developed reporting and accountability, and they want to be really hands-on, you know, something like Jira might be a better fit than GitHub. Or maybe we just need to do some custom spreadsheets when it comes down to it. But there are definitely some typical things, as Joe mentioned. You know, we tend to use a more agile methodology or Scrum methodology, in that we'd like to set up, you know, a work period. So a time box of say 2 weeks to say, we're gonna do a certain amount of work within this 2 weeks. We like to have a ticketing system, whether that is Jira or GitHub or anything like that. And if they are using SVN, we will have a conversation about why we would like to change that to Git if possible. And if it's not, you know what? There's always Git SVN, which we've used pretty successfully before too.
You know, it's crazy too, as I think about this more, is like each of those individual tools that we're talking about, we establish workflows within how we use those too. So Git, as an example, it's like Git is the tool that is a part of the larger process, but we also have processes or workflows for each project for how we're going to use Git. And usually, like, as you're going into a project, or you know, hopefully as you're starting it, you and everyone else that you're working with on that project in sort of a collaborative effort goes through and figures out, like, in this project, this is how we're going to deal with using Git and branches, and who's going to be in charge of merging pull requests, or are we even going to use pull requests, and all of those kind of things. And probably true with ticketing systems and stuff as well. I don't have as much familiarity with the ticketing software as maybe Jared does, but I'm sure there's that process of figuring out, yes, we're going to use GitHub, but also how are we going to use it? But maybe it'd be interesting to talk about some of the processes that we've seen used for, well, probably specifically Git, because I know that's kind of what we were interested in talking about when we first decided to talk about workflow. Like, what are some of the ways that we use Git successfully with teams, but maybe also some of the things that we do with various ticketing systems that have been helpful in our process.
Sure. So Git, you know, Git's really flexible. There's a lot of ways that you can use it and use it successfully. And really, I think what that depends on is everybody just being on the same plate, everybody knowing exactly what the process is and being able to conform to it. Because if you have even one developer who just does things differently, it can really throw a kink in things. I think the best way that I've seen it used, and this tends to be fairly easy for new people to get to grasp, and for even, you know, senior developers, kind of like this flow, is, I said flow and I didn't really mean the Git flow. there's a specific methodology of Git flow, which is fairly complicated. But the one that we tend to use mostly is we tend to work in master. And when I say work in master, what I mean is that's typically where our this is the latest and greatest is. We typically have some sort of ticketing system, as we've talked about, and each ticket tends to get its own branch of code. So when a developer takes a ticket and says, okay, I'm ready to work on this, he branches code directly from master, which you can think of as like head, and it's the latest and greatest. I'm going to start working on a new feature. I'm going to branch that off. I'm going to start doing all of my work for that ticket in this branch. And we'll even have, like, you know, naming conventions for branches that are, you know, related to that ticket. It actually has the ticket number in it, and then maybe a short description. They'll do all that work. And then the biggest change we've made in the last, couple years has been pull requests. So the big thing there is to, here's my branch of code. I want to merge it into master, and I'm going to request that it get merged into master. And then we have a peer review process in which that pull request is looked at by another developer in order to determine things like code quality, or does this break things? Is there something, you know, code-wise or standards-wise that you're not conforming to? Is there a different function you could have used here? Whatever it is, they review that code and they make sure, you know, they merge it in themselves locally or use one of our advanced tools, like through Jenkins, to check out that code and make sure it doesn't break things. And then they merge it, or they put a comment saying, you know, this needs changed. And then it goes back to the other developer and so forth. And then once it's approved, it basically gets merged into master. And then there you have it. That's basically the life cycle of a task or a ticket.
Yeah, that sounds pretty similar to what I'm familiar with as well. We do a similar but not quite the same process on the Drupalize Me project. We actually have a branch that we call dev or development, that all of our feature branches branch off of that dev branch, and then master is reserved for sort of like essentially this is what's on production right now. It's kind of a hybrid between a couple of different sort of defined Git workflows, but it's working for us at the moment. You talked a little bit about like naming conventions for branches. I definitely use naming conventions, and mine, like Jared said, is typically like I like to include the ticket number is basically what my naming convention comes down to. What else do you guys do in terms of naming conventions for creating branches and making sure that it's easy for other people to figure out what the heck is going on here?
Typically, I like to encourage the ticket number first. Whatever ticketing system you're using, however it defines its tickets, Jira will do something like Drupal dash number, and GitHub will just do, you know, maybe a number. But whatever the ticket number is, and then like a dash or a colon or whatever, some sort of separator, and then just a short description in, you know, separated by hyphens or underscores, which is typically like the title of the ticket that you're working on, or just a short description of what it is, you know, upgrading views, whatever.
I think what's interesting though is like in Git, you can name your branch anything. It's totally arbitrary. So like, why a naming convention like this? What kind of benefits do we see from doing that? I know for myself, it makes it easy for the peer review process where I'm looking at a ticket and I'm asked to review the code. It's really easy for me to figure out that must be in the branch 127 because this is ticket number 127. But are there other benefits to this?
Sure. There's, I keep going back to Jira, but GitHub also has a way of basically when you put those ticket numbers in a particular format in your branch name or even in commits, it ties it back directly to what you're talking about. So if you put a commit for ticket number and then a short description, actually in the ticket number, it will reference that commit, and somebody looking at the ticket could say, oh, here's a bunch of commits that were directly related to this ticket. Which is nice when it gets merged back in, because then you basically have the full change set ready to go when you're looking at issues.
So trying to like just draw lines between these different tools that we talked about in the beginning, you've got your ticket tracking system and your code tracking system, but how do you make sure that the sort of related information in the two is easy to find? Yeah. And you mentioned commit messages with ticket numbers. So most of my experience lately has been using Unfuddle, which will recognize a ticket number if it's in a commit message and associate that commit with a particular ticket, but it won't do it based on branch name. So that's kind of a cool new thing that I learned. What about occasionally you work on features that are like encompass multiple different tickets, right? Like, in an ideal world, sure, like we solve one ticket at a time. But in reality, it's often the case that we're solving four or five tickets at the same time and kind of working on all of those in conjunction. I know for myself that in that scenario, my naming convention, I tend to use my name. So I would name the branch like Joe hyphen and then a short description. It's kind of like I don't necessarily have a single ticket number, and I'm certainly not going to, like, you know, sum them all together and then take the square root and make that the branch number. So I tend to do Joe hyphen and then a short description. Do you guys have ways that you deal with that?
That's interesting. I don't think we've really run into that a whole lot. A lot of times I feel that if you have to work on multiple tickets because they're so related, there should be a ticket that's encompassing all of those things. Mm-hmm. I really like to have kind of a strict adherence to one ticket per branch type of thing, so that basically for tracking purposes, if it's across multiple things, it's just harder to track from the ticket side of things. You know, if I'm, you know, being a project manager, I can get into the code and I can look at the things and I can find those things, but it's just so much easier if I don't have to. And it's also easier for people who can't get into the code. So you have a client who is definitely active in your ticketing system, but has no idea how to check out the code, or maybe doesn't even have access to it. It's much easier for them to be able to look at a ticket and say, okay, here's everything that's related to this. And I know that when this is closed out, it's not a bunch of other things. But there's other ways of going about that too, where you could say, okay, maybe there's four related tickets here and I need to work on all of them because they're so intertwined. it's pretty simple to create another ticket that just references those tickets, you know, to just basically most ticketing systems have a way of referencing another ticket item that directly pulls it in or gives it a reference so that you can get a quick status update. Like, you know, when one of those other tickets is closed out, it will cross it out or something. But having those organization like that is pretty important. And I would even go as far as saying if they're that intertwined, to create another ticket and use that ticket that is kind of the parent of all those tickets in your commit messages or your branch names.
That makes sense.
A lot of times this can sound like a lot of overhead for people as well. I've done a fair amount of work with folks who are either a solo developer or a single developer plus another contractor that they've just hired on, and they're trying to figure out, like, what's the tool set that we can take advantage of without it being way too much overhead? And some of the things that Jared's talking about right now, ultimately, you can very quickly get into these situations that if you don't have a number plus naming convention, it can get difficult to remember what exists in each of the independent pieces that you've been working on. So I have worked a lot with solo developers and very small teams to figure out what's a ticketing system that's going to help you to organize things instead of just having another thing that you have to work with. And certainly, Joe and I are using Unfuddle, and having that relationship between the commit message and the ticketing system is really important for reducing the overhead. But just drawing a picture, like taking the time to stop and look at who's on my team, what are the things that we're going to be doing on a daily basis or infrequently. For example, you may be working daily, but you may only do a weekly sort of push to production or show the client on a weekly basis the work that you've been doing. But take the time to stop and create a diagram and make sure that everyone is working from the same understanding. And in the craft world, which is where some of my language around processes comes from, we say, this is how I go when I go like this. And it's one of those situations where if you don't have really clear documentation, if you don't have the step-by-step description of how people interact, this can get really, really confusing. So Jared, and I mean, I know I'm sort of, it's a leading question for me to ask Joe, but Jared, what are some of the ways that you communicate with team members what the expectations are around that process? Do you have documentation within the ticketing system? Is it a separate, like, is it a Google Doc? How do you mm-hmm. lay out what the expectations are for people working together?
It depends on the size of the project. You know, I've been on projects where it's quite simple enough to say, okay, here's a developer who's going to start helping us with the project. And, you know, it's not that big. There's, you know, maybe three other developers or something. And to sit down with them at the beginning and just talk about it. Just say, hey, here's all of the different things. And I kind of end up keeping a mental checklist of what a developer should know in order to, you know, be cohesive with the rest of the team. But there's also situations where the project's huge and maybe there's 12 developers and now we're getting four more. you know, in those instances, it's definitely like, okay, here's the first batch of new people who are coming on. Here's all the things that they need to know. I will sit down and definitely write it out, like in an email. And then that becomes documentation. It ends up getting into the whatever wiki system we're using or whatever, so that when more people come on, I can simply reference it to them. You know, I don't spend more time on things like that than I have to. but it's definitely a balance of also, you know, we talk about the overhead of the process, and that is something I'm very conscious of all the time, on the developer side and on the client side. I kind of mentioned it before, but you have to work with what other people are comfortable with as well. I think once you're in a project and you've established a certain process, then people, you know, new people coming into the project need to kind of conform to that. but I'm, like I said, I'm always open to suggestion on how to improve those processes too. But I don't want developers to be doing a bunch of things that are unnecessary, or that even they see as unnecessary. If it's something that does not help a developer, typically I'm in that role where I need to do it. I will do it instead. To what extent I can. I mean, I can't, I'm not going to go in and change people's commit messages. but if the client is seeing something where they're like not getting enough visibility and I can change the developer's workflow, to give better visibility, you know, those are things I will suggest. But if a developer says, listen, this is just too much, it's taking me way too long to do something, I'll figure something else out where it, the onus is on me to get that information to the client. It's kind of my role, you know, that's where we're at. We are the project managers, are the interface for developers and clients, so that the developers can be as efficient as possible and the client can be as happy as possible.
So we spent a bunch of time talking about branches in a workflow, and that it's sort of arbitrary in Git and a lot of other systems too. You can name your branches whatever you want. One thing that I would recommend is whatever you come up with for a branching system or whatever your workflow entails, it's, I like to advise that you somehow work peer review into your workflow. This concept of like, when I work on something, assuming there's someone else on my team, unless it's just me, maybe I can review my own code too, which I probably should. But someone else on the team is going to take a moment to look at the code that you've written or even the copy that you've written, or, you know, review your solution to a particular problem. And branching, I think, if you do it right, and have a good plan in place, can really lend itself to making it easier to perform peer reviews, especially in the scenario where we're like having one branch per ticket. It's really easy to say, hey, Kyle, can you review ticket 127? And he can find the branch that's related to that. It contains the only thing that's different between that branch and the master or sort of head branch is my solution to the problem. So it's pretty easy to get a diff and see the difference, or like what's changed, and start performing those reviews. So peer reviews being awesome, and also part of a workflow. How do you guys incorporate peer review into a workflow? Like, do you have checklists for doing that? Do you have a standard for who on the team is doing peer review, or any of those kinds of things?
This is an area I'm pretty passionate about, actually. I think peer reviews are extremely, extremely important for many reasons. Code quality being one of them. Just so that somebody else knows what you're doing in case you get hit by a bus tomorrow. You know, somebody else needs to be familiar with the code that you're dealing with so that it's not this black box, this black hole in the project where nobody really knows what's going on there. Somebody, at least one other person, should know what's going on. We don't typically set up really strict peer review processes in that we don't say, like, we definitely say everything, every branch that goes in, every piece of code needs some sort of peer review. I mean, unless it's like, you know, a sentence change in a comment or whatever, you know, if you want to do a hot fix every once in a while, it's not the end of the world. Given what, you know, how much is that hot fix? What kind of risk is around that hot fix? But the peer review process tends to be, you know, it's interesting. We basically say, give this ticket to somebody else who you want to look at it. And that works out really well because you end up knowing who you want to review your code. By the quality of other people's code, by knowing what code that they're putting in, there ends up becoming kind of this hierarchy of, oh, I really want this person to review my code because I know he's going to catch any stupid mistake that I've made, and in turn, that's going to make me feel good about the code that I'm actually committing. or I don't want that person to do my code because I've seen some of their code and I'm always correcting it. So maybe they might miss something. But those things just kind of, it's like the Darwinism of some kind of Darwin rule of code review or peer review. But it also can be a struggle when you get maybe some new developers who aren't used to this process, because it is one of the things that I've found is it is much harder to read code than it is to write code. And so when somebody gives you a task to peer review their code, it's almost like, before you understand like the merits of it and really feel the merits of it and the rewards of it, it's like this onus process of, oh God, I got to pour through all of this code. I got to figure out what it's doing. I got to make sure, you know, it's one of those things that it just takes a little bit to get used to. And it takes a little bit to understand the benefits of, but once you adhere to this process, you end up never wanting to go back. It's that valuable. We don't really have a checklist per se that like we say, okay, everybody needs to go through and they need to run it through, Drupal coding standard, whatever process or anything like that. Those things kind of become mental checklists, and it also becomes almost a matter of pride where you're reviewing somebody else's code and you want to make sure that it's quality code. So you just have kind of a mental checklist of, you know, well, here's the things that I check when I'm coding. So here's the things I'm going to check on somebody else's. And somehow that process gets this amalgamation of standards kind of where everybody kind of understands what's expected of their code and they expect that in turn from everybody else. And it's just I don't know, it's a beautiful thing when it's done well.
I think that in addition to like reviewing people's code as part of the peer review process, one of the things that's really important is just like taking a moment to say, does this thing even work? Like, they provided a solution for it. Can I get their solution to work? And can I look at it and see that, yes, it's performing in the way that we expected it to? And especially with Drupal and tools like features and views, and where it can be really easy to forget to export a field or forget to change something here or there, having that one other person just verify that, yep, you didn't forget a checkbox can be really helpful. Mm-hmm. And then also there's sometimes like the opportunity for me to have someone else look at my solution to a problem and say, you know, I like what you're doing here, but there's a lot easier way that you could have done this in, yep, you know, 10 lines of code instead of the 300 that you wrote. And sure, it's frustrating to delete 300 lines of code and replace it with 10, but man, when I come back like 6 months later and I look at that and I'm like, yeah, I solved that with 10 lines of code. It's pretty mm-hmm. cool.
Yeah, it's a good point, because one of the points of a peer review is not only to just look at the code and understand what the code's doing, but to actually pull it into your local host, get it working with your instance of Drupal, and make sure it's actually doing what it professes to do. And that can be a rather pain in the butt process too. It takes time. And, you know, when you're working on your own code and you've got to review somebody else's code, you'd much rather be working and writing on your own code. So it becomes kind of a tedious thing about code review. And we're actively working on tools that kind of help that process. One of the projects we're working on is, we've kind of dubbed Tugboat, in that it's basically a pull request builder. So when you issue a pull request on your branch of code, we have Jenkins doing an automated process where it completely spins up a whole new version of Drupal with that code applied to master, and allows you to just go and click around and actually make sure that it's solving the problem that is supposed to be solving with that ticket. And that has a ton of benefits. It has a ton of benefits for the people who are doing peer review because they have that automated process. They don't actually have to do this locally. They don't have to worry about pulling that code down locally. They can click around. It also has the benefit of people who may not even have a local host can do some peer review. They can check that piece. You know, maybe you have a client who they're not really interested in the quality of the code. Maybe they trust your quality of the code. They just want to make sure that it works. And this gives them a quick way to do that. And it basically ends up increasing the speed of development when you can get other people in there to just review your stuff. And click around.
It certainly reduces the overhead that is necessary for someone to be able to just like look at the change that you've made and see it in action, which I could see being super useful for things that are like user interface related changes, and you just want to like look, did this line up? Does it work in all of these different browsers? If the site is already kind of in existence for you, and you don't have to go through, even though, sure, it's a sort of small amount of steps, it takes time, and if you're doing it over and over and over.
Also for really complex things like, well, we keep saying workflow, but like actual workflow related things in Drupal, like editorial workflow, that stuff becomes really complicated. And sometimes you really need somebody who's maybe on the editorial team to test this out and make sure it's working. And you can give them a link and say, here's the code that I just did that's hopefully going to fix your problem. Can you just check it and make sure it's actually solving the problem that you reported? And they can look at it and they can say yes or no, or here, maybe that's working, but you know, maybe we want this little bit of a change here or something like that.
Yeah, definitely. So maybe to kind of like start wrapping things up a little bit, we've talked a bunch about different things that you can do with a process and sort of the tools that are involved and branching and creating tickets and tying all of these things together. And ultimately, the most important thing being sitting down with your team and everybody collaborating to figure out what is the process that we're going to use for this particular project. One of the things that I find comes out of those discussions a lot is we often end up with this like, here's the list of Git commands that you need to run in this order to adhere to the process. Here's the things that you need to do with Drush when you check out a new copy of the code in this order to adhere to the process. I like to try to look for opportunities to automate some of those steps of the workflow, because it's like, great, it's documented. I really don't want to copy and paste all of those 10 commands every time that we do this. And so then we get tools like the Tugboat pull request builder, or just things like using Jenkins in order to automate some of the deployment strategies and stuff like that. So I would encourage people to, once you've documented what your workflow is going to be, look for repetitive steps or things that you can automate in that workflow. Even if at the outset you're like, oh, whatever, it'll take 30 seconds every time I need to do it. Over time, 30 seconds, you know, compounds and
adds up.
Yeah,
the Drush is a really powerful tool for that. It's a great place to start with those things, I think. One of our current projects, we have a command just called Drush LU for local update. And what it does is it does the whole automated process of basically updating your local environment with what's on dev. You know, it grabs the latest code, it mashes the repositories, because this is a complex project, has two different repositories. It goes and grabs the latest database dump, and then it comes back with that and like sanitizes it and does all of those things that you normally have to run a few commands and take, you know, maybe the whole process would take 15 minutes, where now it's cut down to 5. And that's a huge time savings over the lifetime of the project. So, yeah, it's very valuable to try to automate.
And it's one of those that you kind of, you look at it and you're like, oh, it's going to take somebody 2 days to write this Drush command. Maybe it's not worth it. But on a project that lasts, like, you know, more than a month, probably worth it to take the time to establish some of those things.
Also something that can evolve. You know, if you start a command like Drush LU and all it does is pull down a local database, then you can evolve it from there. You know, here's another thing we can add, and somebody else adds it, you know. So
awesome. I feel like we could probably go on and on about workflow and process stuff forever, but hopefully this provides sort of a good overview for people. And I don't know, maybe we can like do more podcasts that dive into more detail about some of these other things.
We'll wrap this thing up. I can now completely understand why Jared calls it a process, because, I mean, you start out with this quote-unquote workflow, but inside of a workflow, you've got all of these tools, and then each tool has a workflow of its own. So I can completely understand why it's a process, not necessarily a workflow, because everything does something differently and everything has its own way of doing it. One thing I do want to mention, though, is a shameless plug. We did get on this topic because, Joe, not only are you in Prague right now, which is pretty awesome, but you're going to be at DrupalCon, and you are actually doing a workshop to kind of help people with their process in Git. Is this not true?
This is true. I was thinking, oh, I should probably mention this.
it's your podcast. You can do
Emma
shameless
and
plugs.
I will be doing a workshop the Monday before DrupalCon Prague. It's an all-day workshop where we're basically going to be talking about these types of things, different workflows and processes. We're mostly going to be focusing on using Git and establishing a workflow for either individual or small teams of people that are using Git to build Drupal websites, and sort of talk about the different processes that we use and we've experienced, but also help you gain some tools and knowledge to be able to establish your own processes. The idea is that people come out of this workshop feeling like they have the ability to go back and work with the rest of their team and set up a process that will work for all of them. If this sounds like something that you're interested in, you can sign up for this class by visiting the DrupalCon Prague website. There'll be links in the show notes, I'm sure. Yeah. Ta-da.
Well, very cool. I'd like to thank you guys, and this is some good stuff. Joe, you're right. This could probably be multiple podcasts about each individual parts of the process, but now we've got some more stuff to put in the can for later. But thanks again, guys. One last thing. Joe, I'd like you to end this podcast and go make sure that Drupalize Me starts using Tugboat, and I want this Drush LU. Why do we not have these tools? That would be awesome. But so anyways, I appreciate guys, and thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, you bet.